KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Unions and the Fight for $15 brunch and discussion on Saturday, November 15th at 10:30 a.m. The event features Elizabeth Alexander, Vice President of Politics for SEIU 1021 in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Nicole Grant, President of the Washington Young Emerging Labor Leaders. Again, that's the Unions and the Fight for $15 brunch and discussion on Saturday, November 15th at 10:30 a.m. at the AFL-CIO Oregon, 3645 Southeast 32nd Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tessie Word is KBOO's 2014 Artist in Residence. We spoke to her about her piece Convergence and her beginnings in sound design, and about the experience of being a KBOO Artist in Residence. Convergence will open Friday, November 14th at 6 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland.
I'm Tessie Word, and I'm a sound artist, and I'm the KBOO Artist in Residence for 2014. How did I get into sound art? Well, I've been an amateur musician for a long time in Portland and played in bands and really interested in music. And then I got interested in doing video work through a class at the Film Center. And from there, I decided that I wanted to study more about media and film. In the last few years, there's been so much amazing work, so many tools available for artists to create all kinds of new things. And I took a class called Sound Culture, and it was all about the different ways that you can orient yourself towards sound and kind of opening up your mind to how much sound there is and how much you can do with it. I'd done a lot of short films, and I'd always been the sound person. I kind of fell in love with the monitor, that when you put the headphones on and the monitor is on, everything is so loud, and it's this really exciting kind of hallucinogenic experience. And so I thought, well, how amazing if you just only focused on sound. So I started making pieces, and because of the internet, I found that there's all these festivals and galleries that are interested in showing these things, and you can just, you know, click a button and send this file out. And so I got connected to this community of people who are all interested in how could you tell stories differently with sound. What in our environment are we not noticing that we could become more aware of? Basically, how can you learn more about who you are and where you live and what's going on by being creative with recording sound and listening to the sounds around you and then creating new kinds of pieces that have different kinds of sounds in them? So that was very freeing, you know, and it's also very freeing, and it's also very meditative. So I kind of dove right in. So I've been connected to that community of sound artists and having pieces played around the world, really, for a couple of years. And that was really exciting.
Where are some of the places that your pieces have played?
In Europe, there's a bigger precedent for this kind of work. So in London and in Germany and in Berlin. And I've been a part of the Sound Festival in North Carolina for a couple of years. There's a group in New York that really tries to bring sound art around the country, and they have a competition every year called 60 by 60. And they ask people for 1 minute creative sound pieces, and then they partner with dancers and they tour all around the country. So one of my 1 minute pieces was selected for that. And so people were dancing to it in Lexington, Kentucky, and in Canada and Connecticut. So that was kind of exciting. I've never actually made it to any of these events.
And you've been working on Convergence, your piece that will show on November 14th that you did as the KBOO Artist in Residence. You've been working on that for 2.5, 3-ish years?
I would say I got the idea for it probably 2.5 years ago. I started to turn the ideas over for that about 2.5 years ago. I did the Sou'wester residency, which is in Seaview, Washington. We were trapped on the Long Beach Peninsula because this semi-truck that was driving over the bridge between Astoria and the Long Beach Peninsula was swept over the side and hanging off the edge. And it was there was a huge storm there, 80-mile-an-hour winds, and we were trapped in the area that the residency was, and there was trees going down. I grew up in that area, and I turned on the radio, and it just gave me this huge sense of nostalgia for, as a child growing up in near Seaside, Oregon, the radio was always touchy because in that area there's mountains and the ocean, and it's just really hard to tune in. And so when a storm hits, if you're lucky enough to have batteries in your radio, you still can't really hear what's going on. You know, it's like there's a storm inside the radio too. And there was all of these amazing sounds, these alarm kind of sounds and beeps coming out of the radio in the cabin that we were staying in. That's where I really thought, I have to do a piece that's about this, about being stuck in a storm, trying to listen to things and all of those sounds, the sounds of that experience. So that's where the genesis of the piece first started. It was, I think, Thanksgiving, maybe 2012. Yeah. Out on the coast in rural areas, they have very spotty cell phone coverage out there too. So a lot of people I know are not as inundated or connected to media and internet and their phones all of the time. There's more breathing room. So if you're from a place where you're used to being able to be online or on your cell phone or connected to the media anytime you want, and then you go out there and there's a huge storm and everything is down and you're just totally alone and you're alone with the sounds of impending disaster, it's a very humbling experience. And at the time, I was very impressed with the people around me. Like, a huge tree fell and crushed a trailer right near where we were staying, and everyone just took it in stride. And so that was another part of the genesis for this piece that I wanted to incorporate, was not just the sounds of the disaster, but just the connecting to people from the area where I grew up who they're so resilient and they're so unflappable, and they have a different sense, you know, in connection to nature and being alone with nature. They're not afraid of it, and they're not afraid in the way that, you know, other, you know, we might be. So that's kind of where it all started.
The piece is about the Oregon coast, so it's about being in tsunami zone. So it's about the disaster that is expected,
mm-hmm.
And imminent, but it's just kind of this lingering thing that's out there, which also seems like a really interesting tension to be able to express through sound.
Yeah, one of the other parts of the piece, so the piece is really about living like daily with the possibility of an impending disaster and all of that. But it's really, this piece is very focused on the tsunami that hasn't happened yet. And the reason that I wanted to explore that is I personally, my entire life, have had night terrors about tsunamis. So it's always the same dream where I, you know, I'm trying desperately to get away from the tsunami. And, you know, I feel like it's probably some kind of ancient memory from being a child that I fall down and I can't actually run. I'm just trying to crawl up the hillside and the tsunami is coming. And sometimes I survive and sometimes I don't. And I talked to people about this. And what was interesting to me is that nobody that I talked to there had any similar experience. But I was just at this party and I was talking to, it just happened, there was all these people there from Idaho, and I was talking to them about the piece, and they all live in Portland now, and they all, same moment, realized that they all had similar night terrors as children about forest fires. And so the other part of the piece that's really important to me is the sense that maybe we lose after we grow up of being connected to our environment and the kinds of natural disasters that could occur there that we have all these safeguards for, and that, you know, maybe our parents are always trying to calm our fears, of course. And there's all this structure there, you know, there's dams or there's fire departments, or, you know, there's all this evidence that everything is under control. But I think as children, we sense that that's not really the full truth of it, that no matter how prepared you could be, or no matter how well your community works together when something does happen, that catastrophes do happen, and it could happen to you. So that's a big part of the piece too. And I connected with early on Dr. Ruth Ludwind, who is a geologist. She used to work with the University of Washington. She's now retired. She had a side interest of studying oral histories and how Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest, how they conceived of the tsunami. And tsunamis, really big ones, hit here about every 300 to 500 years. And so passing down these memories and these stories or these images that refer to the tsunami, it was incredibly important, but it was also kind of an incredibly vulnerable, fragile story because so much time would pass in between that how generations and generations and generations of people would be responsible for transmitting this knowledge down. It's very different here than it is in Japan. And so I connected with her early on, and then I felt like that was a really important part of the piece for me too, not just how do we think about this disaster that hasn't happened yet, but also how have people in the past who lived in this place before we did and for longer and had a longer relationship with it, how did they preserve those memories or transmit those memories, because we'll probably be the ones that are here for the next one.
This seems like a good time to actually play some of the piece so people can hear what we're talking about. Is there anything you want to set up?
I contacted some CERT teams in Clatsop County, and I was allowed to come to meetings and tape meetings. And so I'd like to start with a part of the piece where we're listening to a group of people talking about their fears about the tsunami and how they're going to deal with it, because CERT teams are this integral part of the process in an emergency situation, and they're community members and they're volunteers, and they're going to be talking as a group, and it kind of breaks apart because of the fear, and then it goes from there into some other sounds.
And CERT is?
Community Emergency Response Teams. It's a movement which has gotten bigger and bigger in the last few years since Hurricane Sandy, and it's really big in California. And it's basically what it is it's people who volunteer to go through a series of training so that they know how to use ham radios, and they all decide independently what they're going to be trained in. But for example, they could be trained in ham radios and rescue techniques and organizational techniques. They're the people on the ground when something happens. And so on the coast, there's several different CERT teams, and these are the people that, you know, they meet monthly and they talk about, you know, what are they going to do when things go wrong and how can they help support emergency management teams, because the truth of the matter is it's going to be your neighbors. It's going to be the people that live in the area that are going to be the first responders.
I feel good about it now, but like I said, I think there's some more people that need to walk the evacuation routes, as you learned today, that it's like I said, you know, there's 50% of the time, at least in the winter, this happens at night.
Things because so, I'm trying to go through there at night just to see what it was like, and I got all this wrong.
Get people to change their behavior in meaningful ways every day to prepare for something that they've never experienced in their life.
So Convergence will be at the Civilian Studios at 2210 North Lewis Avenue. The opening's Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. Do you want to talk a little bit about the elements that made up some of that piece? Where did the interviews come from? Where did some of the other stuff come from?
So I spent the last year interviewing people in the area that I grew up in, some people that I already knew, some people that I met, for example, the Gerhardt CERT team. And also I interviewed Dr. Ruth Ludwin, who I mentioned earlier, Patrick Corcoran, who's involved in community education around emergency preparedness and works for Oregon State University. And also some of the sounds that are in the piece that were fun for me to capture or interesting for me. I don't know if the listeners would know that we have a tsunami generator here in the state of Oregon, and it's housed at OSU in Corvallis. And it's not always functional, so it took me an entire year to get the sounds, but I managed to go down there and capture the tsunami generator in action, so those sounds are there. Tsunami sirens were turned on in Seaside, I believe it was in 2011. And there's a lot of music, because for me, music is really important. I composed a song for the piece, and it's a more traditional-sounding folk song. And through the experience of listening to all the interviews and really subjecting myself to my fears, I composed a song that incorporates all of that. And so that kind of provides some of the narrative flow. So the piece ends up being, I think it sounds somewhat like a documentary, but there's no script. The song really provides some of that narrative structure so that it's not so abstract. I wanted it to be something that you could be in a dark room and listen to, you know, maybe if there was a disaster happening, and it would feel like a story still.
Here's KABU artist in residence, Tessie Word, with a song from the sound art piece, Convergence.
The orphans of the sea.
That was Tessie Word, KBOO's 2014 Artist in Residence. Her multimedia installation, Convergence, will be featured at Civilian Studios Friday, November 14th through December 14th. The opening is this Friday, November 14th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. Tessie now talks about surprises she encountered while working on this project.
One of the things that was a little bit surprising, I think I mentioned that I have always had night terrors around the tsunami, and most of the people everyone I talked to, no one had the same experience. But when I talked to the experts who know something about the way that the fault lies, the way that the history of tsunamis in the area in the last 5,000 years, we don't know when it's going to happen, but it is going to happen. There is going to be another big quake at some point, and it's predicted to happen in the next 30 years, but we don't know. But I think one of the most surprising things that I learned was that, yes, just like in my dream, the only thing that you can really do is on foot, run away. You need to be aware of your environment when you're at the coast and have a sense of where the escape routes are, because if anything does happen, that's the only thing you can do is run. That was kind of sobering, and I was surprised that there's so many people working and concerned. And when I was growing up there, I don't think that people were as concerned. And I guess there's only been scientific consensus since 1990 about that this is going to happen again. So I was surprised how much the community works together, how much people volunteer to try to, create outreach and have plans and have supplies and are planning to, help each other in the event of a tsunami or a big earthquake. The other thing I was surprised about was I didn't even bring it up. I mean, it was on my mind, but that people would often, apropos of nothing, bring up what they call the other tsunami, that people on the coast are very concerned about sea level rising. They see evidence of that in other environmental pressures on the coast. There's a dead zone off the coast of Oregon. I interviewed a fisherman who was talking about how there just isn't, as many mollusks and clams and starfish as there used to be. He can see that. There's a lot of good things that are happening, like with the salmon runs, for example, some things that are improving. But when I talk to people, they're very concerned about sea level rise and that they called it the other tsunami. Maybe that's what happened, is that when I was talking to people about fear, people on the coast weren't really afraid. They were either preparing for the earthquake and they felt like they just had to be ready, or they've gone through some test runs and they've gone through some evacuations, and so they felt ready. But the sea level rise is something that they know is happening, and it's slow and it's gradual. It's happening right now. And so I think fears about that were more predominant. I talked to a conservationist there, Neil Main, who actually worked with the school district. So I met him when I was a small child at one point. And he was talking about the history and the legacy of control in the area. And all throughout Oregon, dune grass has been planted to stabilize the dunes. And he was talking about, well, what happens to creatures who depend on the shifting sands? That image really stayed with me, that we have become a people that need to make sure that the changes that are natural in our environment, we need to make sure that they don't happen. And so what does that do to us over time? The creatures that depended on the shifting sand dunes are gone now that the dune grass was planted, in the 30s, the Civilian Conservation Corps stabilized those sand dunes. But what happens to us when we become a people that ignores or can't accept or is always focused on permanence, of trying to create this illusion of permanence and stability everywhere we go? Psychologically, what does that do to us? What does that do to us as members of a community? How does that affect the way that we teach our children or maybe lie to our children, because we're so obsessed with this idea of stability and permanence and so afraid of changes? And not even just changes that might be happening right now in our environment, but the ones that are imminent. So I thought about that image a lot when I was making the piece. What happens to the creatures who depend on shifting sand dunes?
As the KABU 2014 Artist in Residence, you will be on the panel to pick the 2015 KABU Artist in Residence. So is there anything you'd like to say to the possibly applying public about your experience?
Well, first of all, I want to thank KABU. It was very humbling to be chosen, and I felt so grateful for the support and the attention that you've given to this project, all of you, Jesse Damon, who did the engineering, and yourself, Aaron Yankee, who listened to me, listened to different iterations of the piece and encouraged me, and just everyone at KABU who, there was just this air of benevolent curiosity towards the work that I'm doing. So often when you're an artist, you feel alone and you feel disconnected, and this experience of being the KABU Artist in Residence completely changed that for me. So I would encourage anyone who's thinking about applying to apply, because it's an amazing atmosphere and there's so much help and support and encouragement, both technical and emotional. And I would say, if there's anyone out there listening, thinking about applying, that if you have a project where you feel it's a risk for you, this is the perfect opportunity for you to put that out there. If you're chosen, then you will definitely have that support to undertake a project that might have some personal risk for you in terms of facing some kind of fear, or if you're going out into the community, being associated with KABU is definitely open doors. I called one gentleman several times to try to get an interview, and when he found out I was working with community radio, he said, "Oh, okay, I thought you were with the conventional media, and so I wasn't going to talk to you." So it definitely could open doors and give you support that you wouldn't otherwise have.
Tessie Word was the 2014 KABU Community Radio Artist in Residence. The program aims to assist artists working creatively with sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KABU mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The goals of the KABU Artist in Residency are to support and invest in individuals who are pushing themselves artistically using sound, whose work will impact the cultural landscape of Portland, and to bring those artists into the dynamic KABU community of local, national, and international artists and activists. Applications for the 2015 KABU Artist in Residence will open December 8th and be due February 13th, 2015. Tessie Word's sonic art piece Convergence will open this Friday at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. It will be up until December 14th. I'm Aaron Yankee for KABU Community Radio.
And now for the KABU News at Noon for Monday, November 10th, 2014. Portland housing officials are recommending lowering their requirements for affordable housing in the South Waterfront District. In a recommendation to the city made last month, they suggested lowering the requirements from 580 to 430 units. The South Waterfront District is located just south of downtown on the Willamette River. It's been subsidized with over $100 million of public money. Most of its housing consists of high-end condos. Housing authorities say they've built 3,000 units in the area and will try and build more affordable housing with the next 3,000. This failure to provide public housing parallels that in the Pearl District. There, developers would need to build 1,300 new units to meet their stated affordable housing goals. President Obama came out today in favor of adopting strict net neutrality laws. He proposed reclassifying the way that broadband providers are treated and making them more like a public utility. Currently, the Federal Communications Commission is considering allowing providers to offer higher connection speeds to customers who pay more. This has received strong backlash by everyone from tech giant Google to the ACLU. The FCC has recorded a record 4 million public comments on the matter. Despite his public statement, President Obama does not have the power to tell the FCC how to handle net neutrality. The Postal Service announced today that it has been the victim of a cyber attack. The assailants may have taken employee information, including social security numbers and addresses. The Postal Service did not disclose how many individuals were affected. It also said that customers who use their central call center may have had their information compromised as well. The FBI is currently investigating these attacks. The Postal Service will continue to operate as usual. And that's the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, November 10th, 2014. Tune in every weekday at 5 for more local, national, and international news produced by our volunteer news team.